So it is my pleasure to introduce once again, and he has been a speaker here probably more than any other person here at Many Rivers Books and Tea, my good friend of 36 years, Jim Wilson. I did the addition earlier today for some particular reason, I can't remember what now, but 36 years. And this time I know there's a treat in store for you because Stuart and I did a radio interview with Jim on our radio program on Saturday about the subject of tonight's talk. And an hour and 40 minutes did not exhaust the topic. We don't have that long tonight, but I know that you will probably have as much to learn as I did about Madame Guyon and Jim's research and affiliation with her work. So I will just say, please join me in welcoming Jim Wilson once again for this talk about Madame Guyon.
Hi, some seats over here. Thank you for, not a problem. Thank you for coming tonight on this cold winter night. Actually, it's a good, it's not that cold, I guess. It's okay. So, I'm going to talk about Madame Guyon, and there's a lot of material to cover, so I'm going to try and condense it. And the talk is going to be in three parts. The first part is going to be her biography, which is kind of, it's dramatic. You know, it's a dramatic story. The second part is I'm going to touch on her overall view of what spirituality and prayer consists of. And then the third part, I want to talk about her influence. Now, any one of those parts could be a talk for the entire evening, and I apologize if I'm running along, you know, and I start going, you know, like really fast or something, please interrupt me. What I'd like to do is at the end of each part, open it for questions. So I'd like to complete each part and then have questions at the end. So Madame Guyon her life was from 1648 to 1717. So she was a contemporary of George Fox in England. You know, like George Fox was 1624 to 1691, so he's a little earlier. And she was a contemporary of Robert Barclay, who's another significant Quaker, and at the end, I'll weave that in. Robert Barclay lived 1648 to 1690. She was born into an aristocratic family, a very large aristocratic family. Both her mother and her father had children from previous marriages, and their spouses had died. You know, like, so she had siblings from her father and mother, and then she had half-siblings, both on her mother's side and her father's side. So it was a very large, complex family, which wasn't all that rare at that time. Like, she, one of a daughter on her father's side, half-sister, was important in her life, was a kind of a spiritual guide. This daughter became a nun. And I think she was like 15 or 18 years older than Madame Guyon. You know, like, from a very early age, she wanted to become a nun. She was very enthusiastic, you know, even as a toddler, about prayer and holy things, always attracted to her, you know, statues of saints, you know, things like that. And she left an impression on people. There are third-party reports about her and this sort of direction, you know, like. And her parents had plans for her, as aristocratic parents often do, and they did not include her becoming a nun. So so they did their best to deflect her interest in that. And at one point, her family was visited by a British aristocrat who was so impressed by this this little girl, that she offered to take Madame Goyon, who would become Madame Goyon, to England, and she would be like a lady-in-waiting for the Queen in England, you know, like, but her parents considered that. It was quite an opportunity, but ultimately they decided against it. But I tell that little anecdote because she really made an impression on people. And So they kept, she would like run off to monasteries, and one of the places she would run off is like to her older half-sister's place. And the half-sister was very, you know, very helpful, you know, would answer her questions and give her rules of prayer or things to do, contemplations. And then the parents would, you know, come up and take her back home and that kind of thing. So she, but her parents were very adamant about that they wanted her to get married, like, and they had plans. And the plan was to marry Monsieur Goyon, you know. So at the age of 15, she was compelled to enter into an arranged marriage with she was 15, and Monsieur Goyon was like about 36 or 37. So, and again, that wasn't all that unusual among aristocrats at that time. You know, like, she immediately ran into difficulties with Monsieur Guillon's mother. She had classic mother-in-law difficulties. because she was in conflict with her mother-in-law, the servants felt free to verbally abuse her and criticize her constantly. And anytime she tried to go into prayer, they would literally take the book from her, you know, like, or the main, from the autobiography, her autobiography, the main thing seems to have been constantly piling duties on her, you know, like, just, you know, like, and more than she could complete, which would bring criticism and, you know, like, that kind of thing. So it was very uncomfortable. Unfortunately, her husband seemed to be unable to find a way of negotiating these difficulties. Her autobiography, it's very interesting. She describes the situation objectively, but she is not judgmental in her autobiography. She's actually quite kind to her mother-in-law, you know, like, and she's sympathetic to the dilemma her husband found himself in. But looking back on it, she regarded it as a kind of spiritual purification, you know, that's how she would interpret it later in her life. She had 5 children by her husband, and I think 3 of them lived to adulthood. And a daughter and a son remained very close to her, you know, like throughout her life, even through the difficulties that would eventually fall upon her. So she was having difficulty praying the way she wanted to pray. Now, what that meant was, in Catholic France at that time, there were complex cycles of prayer. You may have seen them. There's books with multiple ribbons in them, and it has to do with the hours of prayer. There are 8 hours of prayer, matin, lauds, prime, terce, sextnon, vespers, compline, and you cycle through the Psalms, you cycle through other kinds of prayer, and she didn't have the time to do it, and it greatly distressed her. You know, like, so she went to her father and asked her father to interfere, and her father declined to interfere in the family situation, but he did say that I want you to meet this Franciscan monk. I think he will be able to help you. I'm not one who can really figure this out. So let me see here, page 65. So her father arranged a meeting. So she writes, I took with me one of my relatives and went there. When he saw me at a distance, he was quite confused, for he was very particular about he would only see a woman when there were other people present, you know, like to deflect any kind of gossip or difficulties. And he had just completed a 5-year solitary retreat. And he had been given the title of spiritual director in Catholic France at that time. That was an actual title that you would have. And the first person to appear is this young woman, you know, like, and he was thrown. And he told her that, you know, like, that this was not what he expected, and this was kind of confusing to him. So he was then very much surprised that I was the first who addressed herself to him. And what I told him increased his surprise, as he has since acknowledged to me, assuring me that my appearance and manner of saying things had confused him so that he did not know if he was dreaming. So here's this guy, this Franciscan monk, has been on a 5-year retreat. He's now labeled spiritual director, and this young aristocratic woman, you know, shows up, and she's talking about all these theological issues and cycles of prayer and things like that. So he hardly advanced and was a long time without being able to speak to me. I knew not to what to attribute his silence. I continued to speak to him and to tell him in a few words my difficulties about prayer. He answered me, "It is, madame, because you seek outside what you have within. Accustom yourself to seek God in your heart, and you will find him there." On finishing these words, he left. So, for her, you know, I mean, it's very interesting how a word spoken at just the right time, you know, like, it completely changed her view of what it meant to pray and how to enter into spiritual practice, and that it completely turned her mind around, and her difficulties no longer seemed very great, and she was able to take momentary opportunities, all sorts of opportunities arose in her daily life to turn within, and so that was a wonderful, you know, just the right teaching at just the right time, so back home, her husband became sick. In fact, it would be his terminal illness, and they reconciled. It was very important to him, you know, like, that they reconcile with each other, and they were able to accomplish that, you know, like, which is a good fortune, you know, like, and he apologized for not being able to take a stronger role and create more space for her and those kinds of things. And one of the consequences of this reconciliation was that he left all of his estate to her. That was something he could do for her in a concrete way, you know, like, so that she would not be dependent, his mother was still alive, that she would not be dependent upon her, and that she would be able to pursue her religious pursuits, you know, like, and so in France of that day, it wasn't all that easy for a woman to acquire that kind of property and wealth, but he got it down, he nailed it down, and she, you know, was, upon the death of her husband, she now was able to pursue her spiritual path, and she entered into a kind of wandering. You know, she went to Switzerland, for example, worked in a hospital. She had traveling companions with her all the time, you know, like, so she didn't do this alone. But and she went to various cities. She started a house for the poor, what we call charitable work, and she also began giving talks to people, ordinary people, both at the hospital, at charitable work she was doing, and teaching them this method of prayer about turning within, this idea that she got from that Franciscan monk. And she wrote down her her method, what she called her method of prayer, into a book called A Short, it's actually A Short and Easy Method of Prayer. So think of her background with all these complex cycles of prayer, you know, like, and so when she meant easy, what she meant is not involved in all those, with all those ribbons in the book, you know, like, and the other thing in the short and easy method of prayer that she taught is that you do not have to know how to read. You do not have to be educated. You do not have to be an aristocrat. You know, like, you do not have to be, you know, that isn't what prayer is about. And that was an unusual teaching in those days. You know, like, the idea that through prayer you could access God directly, you know, like, was not a common teaching. It wasn't unheard of. For example, this Franciscan, you know, like, taught her, but it was not widespread. You know, like, so we're in Catholic France, Louis the 14th, right, the court of Louis the 14th, Versailles, all that kind of thing. Louis the 14th, religion was an extremely intense issue. It was thought, we're right in the midst of the Reformation. The Reformation began in 1517. Luther does his theses on the door, you know, like, and what Louis had done is he had withdrawn the Edicts of Toleration, which I can't remember who the name of the king who had instituted them before. The French Protestants were known as Huguenots. Almost all of them were Calvinists. And after really horrible massacres of both Catholics and Protestants, I apologize for not remembering the king, but a previous king had issued the Edict of Nantes, N-A-N-T-E-S, which was an edict of toleration.
Was it Henry?
Henry?
I think it was Henry.
It's Henry, okay. And what Louis the 14th did was revoke that edict of toleration, you know, like, and so in France at that time you had to be Catholic, and so all of this agitation was going on. And I want to give you this background because it makes a little more sense about what happened to her, you know, like, so she originally did not want to publish A Short and Easy Method of Prayer, but some of the people whom she taught copied it, and then they printed it on their own, you know, like, and so after that happened, and she became aware that it was circulating and it was being met with great enthusiasm, you know, like, she wrote an introduction and printed it, you know, and she just went with that, you know, like, what was happening. And she did other writing as well. For example, she wrote commentaries on the scriptures. What really interests me about that is her commentaries on the scriptures are all on the Hebrew books of the Bible. She didn't write any commentaries on the Gospels, for example. You know, like, she wrote commentaries like on Genesis and books like that. Her most famous one is on the Song of Songs. And so... Let's see. Initially, her teaching was met with great enthusiasm, and she had a large following. And she actually, remember, she came from an aristocratic family, so there's family ties here. She actually ended up in Versailles. And there was a group at Versailles which was dedicated to reforming the decadence of Versailles. And Versailles really was decadent. I mean, through the teachings of holiness and prayer, they were going to reform Versailles. Good luck with that. Yeah. But there was a group that was there, and they invited her to them. One of the members of this group was Bishop Fenelon. And she met Bishop Fenelon at Versailles. Bishop Fenelon was famous, already famous at that time. He had written a book called Telemachus, which was argued for the education of women. And Thomas Jefferson had good things to say about Fenelon and Telemachus and that kind of thing. So he had a very he had a reputation which was very positive and very good. Versailles, though, was thick with factions and plots and subplots, and eventually what happened was a group decided that her teachings were not up to snuff, and she was she was charged with, let me see, I'm trying to get my timeline right, this is very complicated. Her first arrest over the teachings of the short and easy method of prayer was in 1688 for 7 months. And she was interrogated, and she was successful in defending herself, initially. So then, but in 1694, a group of theologians, including the Bishop of Paris, issued a condemnation of her teachings, a short and easy method of prayer. The big issue for Catholicism at that time was the efficacy of the sacraments. The idea that through the prayer of interior silence, you could directly have an experience of the divine, would seem to undermine the efficacy of the sacraments. Shortly before Madame Guyon started teaching, an almost identical sequence of events happened in Italy. Miguel Molinos wrote a book called The Spiritual Guide, in which he advocated the prayer of interior silence. And again, just like Madame Guyon, but before, he was initially met with great enthusiasm. He had thousands of students, and he had houses were dedicated to this practice of interior silence and prayer. And then he was charged with heresy. His trial took 2 years, and he was thrown into prison. His book was condemned. Hundreds of his followers were rounded up. His book was burned, and he eventually died in prison. And the heresy, the Molinos heresy, was called the heresy of quietism. And the teachings of Madame Guyon were considered to be similar to that. And so she was accused of that. She claimed that she had never read. Of course, she had heard of it because it was a big deal, but that she had not read The Spiritual Guide. That her own book, A Short and Easy Method of Prayer, was not based on that. And I've read both of them, and I think they often draw on common sources, but it's interesting how in history certain ideas will arise, and I think this is an example of that. So she met Fenelon back to, and things are going along. It's a complicated story because there's ecclesiastical rivalries going on. The Bishop of Paris versus Bishop Fenelon is a subtext here. So I can't go into all the details, but she was arrested again in 1695. Her teachings were condemned in 1694. And she was arrested in 1695 and in prison till 1703. And she was moved from various sites, and the last 3 or 4 years were in the Bastille. There's factions at Versailles. She came from an aristocratic family herself, and the factions that supported her worked tirelessly to release her. They didn't just roll over. Fenelon wrote a defense of Madame Guyon's teaching called The Maxims of the Saints, which most scholars consider to be his masterpiece. And so the response to that was to arrest him But Fenelon was a bishop, so he had some leverage, you know, like, and he appealed to the Pope directly to get it out of Paris, you know, like, and Louis wanted Fenelon condemned, and the Bishop of Paris wanted Fenelon condemned, and so the Pope found a few phrases that weren't exactly, you know, perfect, and that seemed to satisfy the Bishop of Paris, and Louis Fenelon was exiled from Versailles and Paris to Cambrai, which is in northwest France. And exile sounds to us dramatic, but it's an appropriate word for given the time, because to not be at Versailles and to not be at Paris meant that your career was over. You would never get any advancement. You would never, you know, like, go any further. So, eventually, the people who were working to release her were successful, and Louis XIV signed off, and she was released. And then something remarkable happened. She was living with her son in southern France. People began to visit her, not just from France, but from all over the world, from England, from Germany, from the American colonies. You know, like, people began to visit her, and she would teach them, you know, like, they would have these conversations, and it's really a remarkable story, you know, like, so she lived for about 12 more years, you know, after she was released, and there was just this steady stream of people coming to visit her and to interact with her, and she met them all, you know, and she would do her best. And then there was also a steady stream of correspondence. She and Fenelon reconnected, uh-huh. like, and and they had people who would hand carry their letters between each other, you know, like, and so her influence began to permeate and percolate, you know, like, throughout in ways that are hard to discern at first, but once you sort of get an ear for it, you see where it comes up. For example, John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, said about Madame Guyon that she was the greatest saint since the apostles. And he was very strongly influenced by her teachings. I think one of the things that I've learned from studying this is that she didn't form a school of theology. She didn't form a sect. And so we sometimes miss how people are influential who don't have that kind of formal apparatus, you know, like, that they've started, you know, like. But her influence is really very significant, and I'll talk more about that at the end. Are there questions or comments?
Thank you. That was so wonderful. Was she aware that she was considered to be a saint during her? Obviously, it was during her life that this man anointed her as such.
The Franciscan.
Yeah, not just the Franciscan, but later the Methodist.
John Wesley's later.
Oh, it's that
yeah.
Came. Okay.
Yeah.
Of course, that would be later. But was she aware that she had that bubble and that regard? And
she does not refer to herself that way.
No, she wouldn't. But
and you know, like, she. What's remarkable is already in her account of her marriage, she had a certain equanimity. Like, she was very sympathetic to her mother-in-law. So already there's a tendency in her to not take her difficulties personally.
Right.
When she was in, here's a story from when she's in the Bastille. You know, like, mm-hmm. They're moving her from one cell to another. They say, "You see that door there?" And she goes, "Yes." "That's where we torture people." You know, clearly a threat. You know, like, and she said, "I will pray for them tonight." Mm-hmm. You know, and that was her response. it really is remarkable. I mean, I think she was a saint. You know, like, I mean,
but there's all these people for coming to see her from all over.
Right.
She had to have had some. I'm not meaning this in some kind of egotistical, oh, look at me, wow,
right.
wow. But in the way that would be that her teaching was meaningful and it actually is reaching these numbers of people.
Yeah, I just don't think she thought of herself that way or considered herself that way. Her anything that she did that was good and that helped people, she attributed to the presence or the divine light.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like,
of course.
You know, she didn't think of it as something that she had accomplished.
Yeah, gotcha.
You know, like, and so that's how she configured it in her own mind. You know, like,
said that she was a contemporary of George Fox, so
right.
But they hadn't met.
No, they did not meet. It is possible Robert Barclay, who was an early Quaker,
mm-hmm.
and wrote a work called An Apology for the True Christian Divinity, he studied in Paris at exactly the time that she was in Paris, exactly the time that her trials were going on. You know, like, so as a young he was a Scot, as a young man, very interested in theology and all these kinds of things. I'm doing research right now as to what kind of influence was there. Was it just circumstantial, or, you know, was he really? I think he was very strongly influenced by her. He doesn't quote her, but there's a strong resonance.
Do they live in the same? You know,
they were both in Paris.
Yeah, they were both in Paris. So
in Paris is a big city.
Yeah,
you know, like
could have been a cross-pollination.
Right. Well, I mean, he went to Paris to study theology. That's what he was studying. So these theological disputes about Madame Guyon's orthodoxy would have been on everybody's mind, and it would have been talked about. So let's spend a few moments talking about Madame Guyon's view, you know, like of, and I'm going to speak in very general terms, and I want to start out by talking about style, and Rob and I have had conversations about this. I often feel that Madame Guyon ran into difficulties because the way to do theology at that time was inherited from the scholastic tradition. So you had propositions and counter-arguments, and it was very rationalistic. The Reformation had completely displaced storytelling and allegory, you know, as methods of religious discourse. You know, like, so what happened was the Protestant reformers defined their particular traditions deductively, you know, like with a set of propositions that you had to sign on to, and you had to sign on to all of them, and then you were a member, then you were a Lutheran, or you were an Anabaptist, or you were a, you know, whatever it was, you know, like, and the Catholic tradition responded in kind eventually, you know, like, so, and they developed their own system, and hence the Jesuits, you know, come into the picture with their highly rational approach to religion. But Madame Guyon did not write that way. You know, like, it's very interesting reading her stuff because it's kind of stream of consciousness, although I don't mean that in a modern way. I mean that, like, she'll be going along, and then that will remind her of something, and she'll go with that, you know, like, and then she'll return, you know, like, to the topic, and then she'll repeat herself, you know, like, and in fact, one interesting thing is a few years ago there was a new translation of A Short and Easy Method of Prayer, and the editor says, "I have removed the repetitions," you know, like, and I get it. I understand, you know, like, because in our modern culture, we want things pretty crisp, you know, like, and but I think, to me, it takes away from the flavor of her discourse, you know, like. The other thing about her style was that she explains her method of prayer through allegory. She doesn't do it, you know, with a set of propositions, you know, like God is such and such, therefore this is the method of prayer to follow. That is, you know, like she doesn't, none of that kind of, none of that approach doesn't interest her. Instead, there's an extended metaphor in A Short and Easy Method of Prayer where she says the path of interior silence is like a sailing vessel leaving the harbor. You know, like, and she said, at first, you know, to turn within, you have to turn away from all the wandering imaginations of the minds and the impulse of the mind to settle on exterior things. And that's like leaving the harbor. It's difficult at first. You have to be careful, you know, and you have to untie the ship, and you kind of have to push it away from the dock, and it takes a lot of exertion and work. And then to get out of the harbor, you have to make sure you get past the breakwater, that sort of thing. But once you're past that, and you put up the sails, it's the wind captures it, and you're off. You know, like, and then she says it just takes slight adjustment to the rudder, and then you're sailing, you know, like on the ocean, you know, like on the ocean of presence, you know, like, and that's how she would teach people. Now, her method of teaching individuals, you know, like, is something that you wouldn't have to be highly educated to understand that metaphor. You know, like, you wouldn't have to be, you know, you wouldn't have to have gone to university, or you wouldn't have to know, you know, biblical languages, for example, you know, that kind of thing. And that's how I think that was why she was able to connect people, you know, like, so directly. And using allegory and this kind of, I don't know exactly, I keep wanting to say stream of consciousness, but that's a modernist term, but I can't quite think of what other word to use. You know, like, it's more like a conversation. It's like you and I are having a conversation, and then, you know, like, we'll be talking back and forth, and I'll say, oh yeah, but I was, you know, remember I was talking about this, so I want to get back to that point. It's more like that kind of flow in her writing. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's, when I first encountered it, I have to laugh at myself. I had a little feeling of irritation, you know, like you know, because I have a philosophy background, and I kind of wanted it laid out, you know, like, more meticulously. But I let go of it, and it's really, there's something almost musical about her, the way she writes, you know, like, when I say musical, I mean improvisatory.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of music. You know, like,
it sounds almost geometric, too.
Yeah, yeah, it's very...
All the different, yeah.
I've really... there's a message and a meaning in her method of communication.
Mm.
You know, like, that I think is very important. You know, like, and she was doing this at a time, and I think she ran into trouble because of this. You know, it's like all the churchmen, they wanted to know her reasons. And her propositions, you know, like, and this doesn't, you know, how does that fit into this doctrine? How does that fit into that doctrine? I mean, it's interesting to me that in her first imprisonment of 7 months, she was actually able to defend herself from those kinds of arguments. So she had the capacity to enter into that, you know, like, but it wasn't her favored way. So, Madame Guyon is considered a quietist. You know, she's part of the, along with Molinos, Fenelon, and a number of others, Malaval. And what that means is that her view was that you need to become completely passive to the presence. As long as you are involved with self, like, or self-assertion, then the presence and the inner light will not be able to manifest. And this is where I think her influence on Berkeley is most striking, because Berkeley actually uses the word when he's describing the inner light, he actually uses the word passive. You have to be passive to the inner light, you know. And she talks about how if you have an experience of presence, she says that the impulse will be to exert effort in order to get that experience again or intensify it. And she goes, that is not the right way with this path of prayer. You know, like, you will only fan the by fanning the candle, you will put it out. You know, like, and so, and she writes about how when you enter into interior silence, you accept whatever happens. You know, like, so you don't go after an exalted experience, but if an exalted experience is granted to you, you accept it. If you have an experience that is dry and uninteresting, that too is a gift, you know, from presence. You know, like, so you don't, so there's a non-discrimination of interior experience that she advocates. So that's a very, it is a radical teaching. You know, like, it is, you know, like, it undermines what I call the athletic view of spirituality. You know, like, where you're training yourself, you know, and you're going to do more prayers and you're going to work harder at this, and then, you know, like, and then you're lifting spiritual weights and you're going to the spiritual gym, and then, you know, voila, you know, like, you finally can climb the mountain and get there. You're a mountain climber. You're and I understand that point of view. I have a lot of sympathy for it. I get it. And in a way, Madame Guyon has a little bit of that. The ship, when it first leaves the harbor, you know, you do have to be careful. You kind of have to exert some effort to get away from the dock, and you have to get past the breakwater, that kind of thing. You know, like, but ultimately, she argues for a complete passivity to the presence. By passive, she meant non-judgmental, non-evaluative, and gratefully accepting whatever is offered, whatever appears in that context. The other aspect is her doctrine of pure love. And she uses that phrase. It's difficult to get exactly what she means by pure love, but part of it is that her unwavering belief that God is love. Like, so that when you are in the presence of love, you are in the presence of God, and in a way, that's how you know that the presence is there. Like, so it's an experience of the heart. In fact, she says several times, this is part of her repetition, that teach people the way of the heart, not of the head. You know, like, teach people the way of the heart, not of the head. You know, like, so pure love means, out of gratitude, you accept the acceptance of whatever is given in that interior experience is grounded on love. You know, like, so you can think of analogies. For example, you love your children, and even when your experience with them is difficult, you still love them. All right. So those kinds of analogies. Right. In the Quaker tradition, this approach is called waiting worship, and I like that analogy. It helps me. It's like if you're in a train station and you're waiting for someone to arrive who you really, really want to see. You know, like, it's, you know, like, you really, really, you know, want that person. You've been waiting to see them. You know, like, so you're there. You might walk around. You might even pick up a magazine. You might check your email. Like, but you don't go too far. You know, like, you wouldn't start a big project. You know, like, because you're waiting. You know, like, for this. And you just kind of accept what's going on in the train station, whatever it is. You know, family runs by, kids run by, you know, people meet, you know, like, a bit of conversation floats, you know, here and there. A train arrives, but it's not the one you're interested in, and then it departs, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, like, you're aware of all of that, but you're not caught up in it. All right. So the analogy isn't perfect because the presence is always there. It doesn't actually arrive, but your awareness of it arrives, if that makes sense. So those are just the other metaphor she uses that I wanted to touch on is sunlight and dew. So the sunlight shines in the morning upon the plants, the grass, and the dew appears and it's cooling and very refreshing to many creatures. And the plants are completely passive. To the sunlight, and the dew arises. She likes that metaphor. Comments or?
That's just so pretty.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Seems like it's a lot like Buddhism, that kind of that simplicity in presence, and not. Not forming an idea and having that passive, we might say receptivity, but the passive experience.
I have found that the interpretation that I feel maps closest onto Madame Guyon's teachings are found in Taoism. I mean, it's not a perfect match. We're talking about a completely different culture.
Very similar to Scientology, too.
To Scientology? Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with Scientology, so I can't say. So, in the Tao Te Ching, I'm sorry I didn't bring a copy with me, but I believe it's an early chapter where those who speak do not know, those who know do not speak. The sage... does nothing and everything is accomplished. It's interesting that Madame Guyon, at one point in A Short and Easy Method of Prayer, just in passing, she says that this method of prayer fulfills the highest evangelical precepts. So I was wondering, what's she getting at there? Well, in the Reformation period, all the various factions were trying to convince everybody else that they were, they were the one true interpretation. And that's what they meant by evangelical. You go out and you convince others. So that was very interesting to me. What was she doing? What she was asserting is that the experience of interior silence is like putting a light on the table and it illuminates the world. And that was her conception of what being evangelical meant.
Right.
If I could make a distinction, she was being evangelical without proselytizing, if that makes sense. It's very interesting. And so now I'd like to move on to her influence. I've already, touched on this a little bit. She directly influenced John Wesley, and John Wesley encouraged people to read her works, including her biblical commentaries and A Short and Easy Method of Prayer. A lot of her works have not yet been translated into English. I've only recently become aware of that. And some of her works are just being discovered. Mm. Isn't that interesting? She wrote her autobiography, which is 2 volumes, and then she wrote a memoir of her years in the Bastille. And she did not publish that, because it was too dangerous. And she handed it to a friend who handed that. It ended up in the Bodleian Library, where it was discovered about 15 years ago.
Wow.
You know, like, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, I don't know the details of, you know, hand to hand, you know, like, but it's the actual manuscript in her hand at the Bodleian Library, you know, like, and an American scholar by the name of Nancy James discovered it and has published it, you know, now, you know, like, so now we have detailed first-hand knowledge of that period in her life, you know, like, so... It's very interesting. The other point about her influence that I would like to make is that Patricia Ward has written this book, Experimental Theology in America, Madame Guyon, Fenelon, and Their Readers. And what Patricia Ward talks about, her view is that Madame Guyon planted the seed for the ecumenical movement. You know, like, because in those last 12 years of her life, people came to visit her, and they were pietists from Germany, you know, like Anglicans from England, and Presbyterians from Scotland, and Quakers from the colonies and from Britain, and she did not ask them to convert to Catholicism. She would treat everybody equally. You know, like, no matter what. And she actually encouraged people to bring the prayer of inward silence to their particular tradition, like, rather than trying to get everybody into the same tradition. This is a contrast with Fenelon. Fenelon had a lot of visitors as well in Cambrai. And the first thing he would do with visitors from Scotland, say, is, you've got to become a Catholic. Mm-hmm. That was his very first, you know, like, effort. You know, like, he was very serious about that. So part of that contrast is that he was a bishop of the church. You know, like, she was a laywoman. You know, like, and but I think it goes deeper than that. You know, like, I mean, I'm not, to me, her interaction with people in those last years, there's something astonishing about it. You know, like, in the midst of all that friction that was going on in Europe, those religious things, that she would be able to be spacious enough to not be a part of that. I think that's amazing. You know, like, and yet she was able to do it. And Patricia Ward gives a very detailed account of how Madame Guyon, it says Guyon and Fenelon, but really she's interested in Madame Guyon, how her ideas spread, you know, like. And once again, I want to bring up, you know, like, for me, this has been a great teaching in how I perceive significance and influence, you know, like, my tendency, you know, from my, say, my Buddhist days was Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, Nichiren, the founder of Nichiren Buddhism in Japan, you know, like, Hui Nang, the founder of Zen in China, you know, like, Nagarjuna, the founder of the Madhyamaka school of Buddhism, you know, it's that kind of thing. But she didn't found a school. This method of interior silence, she didn't discover it. It was submerged in Western spirituality, but you can find, for example, in the 3rd century works of Dionysius the Areopagite, he has a very similar teaching. But this stream of mystical insight became very, it was almost completely lost. It went like subterranean. Like. And so... it was just by her life that she taught people that this is possible, you know, like, that we can share this, you know, that we can share spirit, you know, like. She didn't write a treatise about that. She embodied it.
But in a way, she was teaching the way.
Yeah.
Like, that your connection with Taoism.
Right.
So that's very significant.
Yeah, I agree.
It doesn't require a school or a sect.
I mean, to me, you know, like, my admiration for her when I first heard about her, my admiration was that here was someone who walked their talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they embodied their, they embodied mm-hmm. what they spoke. And I, you know, like I wouldn't have blamed her if she had, you know, signed, you know, confessed and gotten out of her difficulties. You know, like, I mean, I wouldn't have, you know,
right.
like, I would not have held it against her. You know, like, if she had taken an easier route. You know, like, and there's an example of integrity, and it really shows the power of that inner experience. You know, like, and the grounding that that can have, you know, like.
Interesting that you, that she went within, that was her whole life, and her teaching, and then you used the word spaciousness.
Yeah.
And that that's the product.
Right.
And it's an unusual dichotomy, or?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and yet it seems to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did she remain a Catholic all her life?
She considered herself a Catholic.
How is she regarded by the Catholic Church?
She is, theoretically, she could be rehabilitated in the sense that that in spite of all the investigations and interrogations, she was there was no official statement that she was a heretic. Right. And she always had her defenders, so there was a lot of friction. Right. She is considered a quietist, and quietism is still considered an official heresy in the Catholic Church.
Mm,
so if
really?
You go, if you go to the Catholic Encyclopedia, and you look up quietism, mm. heresy. You know,
wow.
That is a heresy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she is associated with that.
Wow.
So
yeah.
is that because of hesychism?
It does. It goes back to that.
Yeah.
What's
just
that?
Hesychasm is an orthodox method of prayer.
Right. Just like that.
That's very similar to that, to what Madame Guyon teaches. I don't think she was aware of hesychasm. I would be very surprised if she had any knowledge.
That's what she was doing.
But that's what she was doing. Yeah. And one of the splits between the Eastern Church and the Western Church was about the interior light and methods of attaining that. You know, like so. As long as you brought that up, Eastern Orthodoxy has never produced like a Summa Theologica or, you know, like a completely systematic presentation of their theological views.
Philokalia is pretty close to that.
I understand what you're saying, and yet to me the Philokalia is not like Summa Theologica. It's not a set of propositions and counter-propositions and arguments, you know, like...
It's more what she was doing.
More what she was doing, yeah. So, the West took a turn, and I've had conversations with Gus about this, you know, like that it took a rationalistic turn, and the Reformation was both a climax and fueled that, you know, like, and we are inheritors of this. And that's the other thing that I, in terms of our situation at this time, you know, like, for example, take how Madame Guyon read the Bible and her commentaries. She takes a completely allegorical view of Scripture. Mm-hmm. She says that in A Short and Easy Method of Prayer, that if you go within and you find the interior presence, it will unlock the meaning of Scriptures, and that without that interior experience, you will never understand them. You actually cannot understand them, you know, unless you have that inner experience. So, she does Genesis. She regarded the entire Bible as an elaborate allegory for the experience of inward silence. So take her commentary on Genesis. So Genesis, everything was chaos, let there be light, and there was light. So what is this light? This is 2 days before the sun, the moon, and the stars. So it can't be the, it can't be a natural light. And so, like, she starts there, you know, like, and that light is the interior presence. And she reads Genesis as announcing that you must read it allegorically. You know, the very first passage of Genesis is telling you, you know, like, that the light they're talking about is not a scientific, observable, or literal light.
Totally makes sense.
She's
so
cool. Yeah.
In Moses' time, there, that light existed when there was darkness and there was light for the Jews, and there was, but there was darkness for the others.
So
the Egyptians.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so what is that light then if it's not associated with the sun?
Right. This allegory, to me, this is one of the important lessons to learn from her, that I've learned from her, and that is that for centuries, Jews and Christians interpreted scripture allegorically. Philo of Alexandria said, you know, like a Jewish writer in the a contemporary of Jesus, argues that just like Madame Guyon, you cannot understand scripture unless you understand it allegorically. All right? And the standard mode for centuries in Christianity, they were influenced by Philo, and they would do it, you know, like they would do these allegories, and they would even use puns to, you know, link certain passages together. Somehow that got lost. There's an interesting, I'm going to bring Gurdjieff here now, just to complicate things, but he had a theory that modern humanity has actually lost the mental capacity to think allegorically.
Oh, wow.
That capacity has atrophied.
Oh,
you know, like, and you know, that he almost thought of it physiologically. You know, like, I think I'm not clear about that, but he did say that one of the traits of our modern situation is that we've lost the capacity to enter into that allegorical dimension. You know, like, and we can't. And we really have to work at it. But one of the things I'm grateful personally to Madame Guyon is she is reawake. I mean, I knew that intellectually. You know, like, I got that because I'd read Philo and, you know, this, that, and the other. But reading her commentaries and, like, on the Song of Songs, it was gone, oh, you know, like, now I really see how this sings, you know, like, and how this unfolds, you know, like, in a very natural way of unpacking it. It adds a whole luminous dimension to words, you know, like, So
beautiful, yeah. Mm. That's really amazing. I'm so happy you presented this.
Oh, thank you.
I have never heard of her.
Yeah, you know, that's part of what I was going to say about influence is she's not well known, and part of that is because she didn't found a sect. You know, like, or a particular school.
Right.
You know, like, and so we all know about Martin Luther because he founded Lutheranism. You know,
right.
Like, and, but it really has shifted my understanding, you know, and I'm beginning to see a broader understanding of historical significance, you know, like, or how a person can plant a seed and have it grow and influence the entire ecology, you know, like of a region. And you know, she wasn't. I don't think she was interested in founding a sect. Like, somebody asked about. Oh, Betty asked if she was Catholic. She considered herself a Catholic. She never considered her teaching radical. Like, she didn't. She did not set out to be a reformer or, you know, do that kind of thing, but every step she took led her in that direction, from teaching ordinary people about a path to prayer that didn't require a sacramental apparatus.
Oh, she was just so clear. She could just see it.
Right.
So she was just so clear. She was like just the thing she had to speak to.
Right.
Yeah.
And
more of an ancient. She had a very ancient view. That was the way the ancients saw spirituality.
You know, that's a good way of putting it. It's like she was born out of time,
exactly.
From another time.
She was tapping into the way that the original mystics were.
She was reborn.
She was reborn, yes.
But she does have used in her title simple prayer.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, a really important key.
Yeah, she actually uses the word easy, isn't that? It's sort of, it has, I always think that that's kind of funny, you know, like, I think she was, might have been teasing the powers that be by saying, you know, like, you can have your complex difficulty, you know, difficult things that require...
Like finding the time.
Right, you know, like, I mean, the way prayer was being taught in Catholic France at that time, you had to be highly educated. You probably had to know biblical languages. Some of the prayers would be in Latin, you know, like maybe a lot of them. You know, like, the books themselves were expensive.
Boy,
you know,
the classes.
Right.
So you had to have a certain amount of money.
And then you had to have leisure time. So part of what she learned, you know, like in her marriage, was that wow, this is how people live. You know, I mean, she was raised in an aristocratic family. You know, it's like. And then she was like given all these, you know, these duties. This is how people live. You know, like, I mean, they're busy. Their life has all these burdens and these duties that you have to perform. And then, as an aristocrat, for her to go through an experience of being in prison, you know, like for a long period of time, stripped of everything, you know, of the comforts that she would have taken for granted. As the child of an aristocrat, you know, like, and to not have that turn her bitter and vindictive is extraordinary.
It's true, because if she were raised that way, which you say she was, and then her husband continued the support system, the money support system under her, geez, that's a huge shock.
Right.
No prep at all.
Right.
Right. That's sort of like a kind of Buddhist allegory, in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you... Yes.
Yeah, coming from the palace to the street and seeing the, you know, the actual way that people would, you know, sickness and death. But it's fascinating. So she really had no holds barred in prison. It was a bare, minimal...
Yeah.
Okay. Severe, probably.
Yeah, and she would be interrogated periodically for, you know, like 10 hours at a time, you know, like, and like one time she had an associate, I can't remember his name, he was imprisoned also, and there were charges of intimate contact between them, which were completely false, because they were never alone. I mean, she traveled with a group, but they gave her this letter in which he allegedly confessed to their illicit, you know, like, contact. And this is really interesting to me. She said, well, let me see the letter.
Yeah.
You know, like, I want to see it. I want to see the actual letter. You know, you know, like, and she just stuck with that, you know, like, and so, and then she said, well, I'm sorry, but this is a forgery, because look at this, look at that. You know, he wouldn't write that way. He wouldn't use
words.
Those phrases.
Yeah.
It's not, those aren't his words. And it, look at the handwriting, is not his at all. You know, like, and she was right. It was a forgery. Incidentally, this friend of hers died in prison. You know, like, so that was tragic. You know, like, so what can we take from Madame Guyon? And for me, it's that I have learned from her that it really is possible to contact the interior as you walk about your daily life. You know, like, it's not easy. You have to get the ship out of the, you know, out of the port, and sometimes the tides are moving in the wrong direction. You know, like, but her life has inspired me to realize that, yeah, you know, it really is possible, and it is possible to reside in that state continuously. It's not easy to do it, you know, like, and I'm not as, my depth of understanding is not as great as Madame Guyon's, but her short and easy method of prayer is a method that I have adopted, you know, like, and that I find very nourishing, and whether you adopt her actual method, I think she can inspire people to realize, to understand that this kind of realization is available and is actually possible, even in the midst of the difficulties of our everyday life. And that is a great gift that she has given people.
Yeah, thank you. Study in equanimity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and thank you for transmitting, being a transmission for us to get this tonight.
You're welcome.
It's like such a gift.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So, thank you. That was lovely. And thank you all for coming tonight. Many of you know the routine here. I will commend to your consideration many books that Jim has brought into the store about Madame Guyon, and some books that illustrate the effects. For instance, this Guide to True Peace, this Quaker document, is lifts wholesale pieces of Madame Guyon's Short and Easy Method of Prayer.
A Guide to True Peace actually takes passages from a Short and Easy Method of Prayer and then integrates them. I'm sorry, thank you for reminding me that. Can I take just a moment to talk about that? So, A Guide to True Peace is kind of, I call it a literary collage. There are passages from Madame Guyon, passages from Molinos, passages from Fenelon, and then they're stitched together by the collators with their own understanding. And it was published in the early 19th century, 1813, and became very, very popular in the Quaker community, you know, like, and it's heavily influenced by Madame Guyon, and
then we have all these other books. She wrote a lot, as it turns out, even though not all has been translated, as Jim pointed out. Nevertheless, there's a lot of work here, including a couple of copies of the Short and Easy Method of Prayer, but also the autobiography, Song of Songs, her commentary on that book of the Bible, etc. So there's a lot of stuff to look at there. We also have a donation bowl over, and we encourage you to contribute to it to help maintain this space and to help maintain the speaker tonight. So thank you all for coming.
Thank
tonight.
You. Thank you for coming. Good to see you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Jim, that was so inspiring.
Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it.
Oh,
thank
I
you.
I love it. Listen, Jeffrey, I made a point to come.
Good.
Thank you. I want something that I don't know what to get. I want to read what she had to say. Is that a good one?
I recommend this one, and
okay.
We're out of it,
okay.
But I can put, it's on order, and I can put one aside for you.
Okay. Let's do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let me write it down.
Thank you.
That was so wonderful.
Oh, good. Thank
you so much.
And your name?
It's Jamuna. And my last name is Llewellyn. It's Llewellyn. And my phone number is 707-887-2679.
Okay.
Is that the best one for me?
I think this is the best.
Okay, good. Okay. Better than thank you.
I think this is a better translation than this. I can get it for you. I'm out of it at the store. This is fine, you know, but I think this is better.
Okay, well, actually, let me get the best. Is this in paper? Or?
No.
No.
But it's only $9.95.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I
would like one of these then, too.
Okay, and your name?
I'm Cynthia.
That's right. And a phone?
827-3452.
Okay.
And one question I have is this is not the edited one here, where is that edited repetition?
No. So that's why I prefer this one.
Right.
It's all there.
It's all there. And you know, one thing that sort of popped through my head when you were saying it was how to keep it.
I got your book.
Oh, good. Thank you. That's good. That'll work, yeah.
And actually, associated is really the metaphor.
Right. It makes sense. It fits in with her allegorical interpretation.
Yeah.
I can see it flowing smoothly from association to allegory. Thank you. Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it. It's gratifying.
Sorry about that.
Oh,
definitely a prayer for
us.
Hi.
How much is that?
$9.95.
Is that that's the price?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And how does it work?
You just buy it at the register.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very good. I'm glad I came.
Okay.
I'm glad asking
Me
to come because I probably wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad. It was good. It was good to see you.
Regular,
I have that book on the last pagan generation, the final pagan generation. So do you want to see it now or do you want to
look at it now?
Okay. I won't get it.
It is really, to me, such a deep thing. If it's something that has resonated.
I actually have a poem. It's the first one that I've ever liked in 72 years. And I don't know where I got it. It's laying next to my